In this lecture, we will consider two sections from the second chapter of Davis's book on the Seven Ecumenical Councils and his chapter on the Council of Nicaea. And we will look at two sections, sections 2.1 and 2.2, the first dealing with the Trinitarian problem and proposed solutions, that is, theories of the Trinity before the time of Arius, and then we will look at Arius' doctrine, Arius himself. There are excellent summaries of these two sections at the end of section 2.1 and in about the middle of section 2.2, both of which have been labeled with blue bars on this web page. The summary of the Trinitarian problem, and then in section 2.2, Arius' doctrine. If we could begin with section 2.1, the Trinitarian problem, it's divided up into different sections, that is to say, different groups within the developing Christian church, which had their own perspectives, which both lent vocabulary and in some cases raised questions or even created heresies in regard to the nature of the Trinity and the relationship between the persons within the Trinity. The first section to be considered is Jewish Christianity, and Davis mentions in particular the Ebionites, who had a doctrine that included a rather complex angelology in which the Son of God was the leader of these angels. Jewish Christianity tended, as a rule, to want to keep a distance between Creator and creation, and with Christ as incarnate, that raised significant questions about the relationship between God, Yahweh, God the Father, and Christ as his Son. Judeo-Christianity, as he points out, tended to emphasize, in trying to get some sort of notion that would encompass the divinity of the Son, tended to emphasize the notion of the name of Christ, or the name of God, as it would have been used, as this terminology would have been used, especially in the apocalyptic Jewish literature, in which the name of a thing is a very powerful aspect of it and carries a quasi-divine character. The Jewish Christian tradition also, in addition to just the Ebionites, had a notion of Christ as angel, Christ as representative, or as the first of the sons of God. None of these obviously are adequate, but they provide a kind of a background for reflection on the question of the relationship between Christ and the Father. The next section, section 2.1.2, concerns Gnosticism, and this is, by the way, a very excellent introduction to and compendium of Gnostic doctrine, insofar as we can reconstruct it. He points out, quoting Lonergan, that this represents a shift from the notion of a chosen race meeting God conceived as a person in history to a more intellectualized, spiritualized, noetic notion that has a world of theory controlled and directed and controlled by practical common sense. The Gnostic tradition is full of all kinds of speculation and conclusions about the Supreme Father, the author of all things, and then the emanated realities that come from this divine origin. If you drop down to the highlighted text describing what conceptions are of value to scientific theology, after describing the complexity and almost the bizarreness of the idea of emanated primordial couples, groups of 8, groups of 10 and 12, various kinds of eons or divine entities constituting a pleroma, and the necessity for the individual soul, which in a sense is a fissioning off of certain aspects of this, to get back into union with the divine through the wisdom or the knowledge that God, that Christ offers, and the possibility of making a kind of spiritual progress through the realms that are guarded or guided by these various entities. After a description of the system, there is a nice compendium, as I mentioned, of the ideas that would become of value to the later theological tradition. And the first is the notion of emanation, the idea that there can be a kind of an act of not so much creation as a kind of making of an other, but which continues to allow the other to participate in the essence, the nature, the very being of the one which emanates. And going with this is a notion of what in Latin would be described as consubstantiality, of a homoousios, of an identity of essence, that there can be the same essence bestowed, partaken in, very much participated in by that which is emanated. Now, this is not a doctrine which in itself or by itself is particularly helpful, but it creates a mindset that will allow individuals to be able to bridge the gap between the Jewish and even the Platonic and Neoplatonic vast distinction between the Creator or between the Father of all things, between the One on the one hand, or God Yahweh on the other, and that which is created. This idea of emanation will at least create a notion that allows for a participation between the God who is utterly transcendent, who is other, and that which has been made, although it will have to be modified and adapted rather drastically. If we skip the section on Irenaeus, although this is very useful to look at and use as a review, in section 214, Davis describes adoptionism, the tradition in which Christ is a mere human being in whom God dwells in a special way. He is, as it were, adopted into a particular relationship with the Father. If we drop down to modalism, which is in a sense the opposite of adoptionism, here we have a notion of the full divinity of Christ, because there isn't really a clear distinction between Christ and the Father. It's as if Christ and the Father are two different modes or names or, if you will, aspects by which the One is known. And this is very problematic because it doesn't allow for adequate description of the distinction between the divine persons. But modalism would become a common, a kind of a reflex position of those who were attempting to combat Arianism at a later time. Marcellus of Ankara, in particular, will espouse a kind of modified modalist position, which is hinted at here in the area that's been highlighted in white and dark brown. From Sibelius, perhaps, comes the notion of a primordial one, which by a kind of an expansion into creation, or into being, engages in acts like creation and then redemption, and then, as it were, contracts back into being just the One. So one can see that there's only a kind of a limited or temporal or situational involvement of God in various things, which does not distinguish between God's nature or God's inner self and the divine persons. So the modalism option is then followed in section 216 by Tertullian's subordinationism, a description of Christ as divine but subordinate to the Father, that is, in an inferior position or relationship to the Father. This would be very common and extremely widespread in the tradition. The Trinity is three in quality, not in quality, but in sequence. Tertullian says in the highlighted section there, different not in substance, but in aspect, not in power, but in manifestation, a kind of a notion of hierarchy in which Christ is at a lower level than the Father. There is not really equality between the three divine persons. There is a kind of hierarchical relationship between them, with the Father at the top. Under Hippolytus and Novatian, one finds a description again of a different kind of subordinationism. This kind of language or tradition will become extremely common. The Father is in some sense antecedent to the Son, and therefore the Son is in some way less than the Father. And that will be a characteristic of subordinationism. While acknowledging the full divinity of Christ, insisting that Christ is in some sense less than or inferior to the Father. Another way of describing this, and a tradition that Arius will pick up on, is to say that in some way the Son of God is a work of God, therefore the Son of God is made and thus inferior to the Father. This will be a particular problem when one then transposes this into the dimension of time, and the Arians will insist that there was when Christ was not. Again, just a reminder that subordinationism will be regarded as heretical, but it is an attempt to describe the relationship between the persons of the Trinity at a time when precision and vocabulary didn't quite exist. There's a very good summary just before section 218 on Origen that talks about the problem of terminology. The later use, the later very specific terminological use of hypostasis and ousia as ways of describing a person and essence or substance is not precise at this time. And there is a difficult kind of almost identity with these two terms, an imprecision in the Greek theological use of them that causes the Latin-speaking world to be deeply perplexed. So the development of precision with use of these terms awaits a later time. If you look at Origen, section 218, Origen affirms the Son's full divinity, and yet he too ends up asserting a kind of subordinationism, a subordination of the Son to the Father. And then in section 219, there's a summary of all of these different positions, which I'd encourage you to go back and look over again in more detail. If we drop down now to Arius and the beginning of the controversy, section 2.2, there is a description of, or rather an attempt to describe, something of what may have been Arius's sources, what caused this priest of the Diocese of Alexandria to take a position, as he did, against the specific advice and recommendation, both of his bishop and then of a council that was called. Things that went into his position seem to have been, as you see in the highlighted text here, his teaching that he received from Lucian of Antioch, about whom we don't know as much as we would like, but which probably influenced Arius's literal exegesis of the scripture, his strong emphasis on the unity of God, and his tendency to distinguish between the logos, between the word and God. He believes in a subordinationism, and he insists that the Son is distinct from the Father, and he emphasizes, Arius does, the notion of the Son's creation from or begetting by the Father. And there's also a suggestion here that perhaps it's from Philo, that he has a resolute monotheism. One might wonder also whether there's not a hint of influence from Plotinus in his sense of the absolute transcendence of God, and therefore the necessity to distinguish between the transcendent God and the created Son. Davis also emphasizes, perhaps from Philo, the notion of a contingent universe that would require an intermediary, namely the Logos, for the uncreated creator to act, and the idea of the Word having been created as an intermediary. And also, Davis points out Arius's use of syllogistic reasoning. Now, in section 221, there is a summary of Arius' doctrine that is very helpful. General statements, an emphasis on the transcendence of God, the essence of God being transcendent, unique, and indivisible, and therefore incapable of being shared. Arius does not believe in or does not appropriate this language of emanation. If God is utterly unique and transcendent, the nature of God cannot be shared. It belongs to God alone, and therefore the Son cannot possess an identical nature with the Father. So, he says, whatever else exists must come into being not by communication of the divine being, but by creation from nothing. Therefore, the Word, Christ, the Son, must be created from nothing, and therefore is a creature. The Son becomes an instrument in the act of creation, and then there are a number of conclusions that I've numbered 1 through 4. There was when he was not. Therefore, the Word had a beginning in time, the Arians will assert. Arius will say that the Word is incapable of any communication with or direct knowledge of God beyond that of other creatures. He is called Word and Wisdom only because he shares in that, in God himself. He concludes, Arius does, that the Word is liable to change and even to sin. And finally, even if Christ is called God, he really isn't truly God. He is God in name only. Christ is therefore the created Word, distinct from the Logos, lacking the Logos reason, immanent in God, uniting himself to a human body that lacked a rational soul. The word therefore takes the place of the rational element in this human composite. So all of these are the aspects of Arius' conviction that the Son is created, and therefore the Son is not of the same essence, not of the same nature as God. Arius is condemned by his own bishop, Alexander, and by a council that Alexander calls. If you drop down a little further, he then flees to Caesarea and makes friends with Eusebius, the bishop of Caesarea, who initially becomes his defender, as well as his even more important defender, also named Eusebius, Eusebius of Nicomedia, who after Arius's fading away and his death will become the leader of the Arian party during the important decades that follow the Council of Nicaea. And there is a description of the anticipation of the council, Constantine becoming the ruler of the whole Roman world. Doesn't appear to have really understood the controversy very well, but his religious advisor, Osius or Hosius of Cordoba, attempts initially to be the, as it were, representative of the emperor, and he goes about trying to anticipate what will ultimately become the decisions of Nicaea. Osius creates a council that meets at Antioch, and in this council, for the first time, a creedal statement is issued. A creed not intended just for catechumens to learn about the faith, but a creed designed for and by bishops, which articulates the faith of the Church. It's a rather unwieldy creed, which we don't need to look at in detail, but it anticipates what will ultimately be done at the Council of Nicaea, which we now turn to.